This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. For the second straight day, Israel is fighting Hamas militants and Hezbollah, which attacked Israel from Gaza and Lebanon yesterday. Details from the BBC's Simon Jones.
This morning, Gaza is shrouded in smoke. Israel says it's cutting off the supply of electricity, fuel and goods to the city. The Israeli military says it has also carried out strikes into Lebanon after shots were fired from the north. The escalating violence will be discussed today at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Hamas shows no sign of pulling back. The Israeli Prime Minister is warning of a long and difficult war.
The current Israeli death count is 500, with nearly 2,000 injured. Cities across the U.S. continue to ask for federal assistance to help with settling migrants.
Migrants are bused from border states to northern cities every week. In Chicago, thousands, including children, are sleeping on the street, inside police stations or the airport, as that city hurries to build more shelters before winter. There were more than 200,000 apprehensions of migrants who crossed the border illegally in September, the highest level this year.
That's CBS's Michael George. Auto workers remain on strike. WBBM's Charlie DeMar has the latest from Chicago.
This ongoing strike now in its fourth week, and members have been picketing in 20 states, including right here in Illinois. Those striking workers were joined by UAW President Sean Fain during a rally.
We at the UAW today are being ridiculed and mocked for our demands too. But the CEOs and the cronies forget about the working class, and they forget about one thing. We've got the power.
Workers are demanding better pay, a four-day work week, and changes to their health care and pension plans. Two people have been killed, three others injured after a shooting last night in Inglewood, California. Kathy Joseph lives nearby.
Who would just walk up to someone and shoot them? Five people? That's kind of ridiculous and scary. So for that to happen in this area is really not right.
No arrests so far. The nation's three major credit bureaus say they will provide free credit reports to consumers once a week forevermore. Here's CBS's Christopher Cruz.
The decision by Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion means you can get your credit reports at annualcreditreport.com throughout the year. The weekly access program began during the pandemic and is now permanent. Consumer Reports says getting regular free access to your reports and reviewing them carefully will help ensure they're free of errors that could lower your credit score.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The lights are on.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A bill in the Wisconsin legislature would make financial literacy classes mandatory in order to graduate from high school. An expert on student loans agrees that's a good idea. Roz Brown reports.
Billy Hensley with the National Endowment for Financial Education says many students are not financially savvy and don't understand scholarships versus grants or federal versus private loans and can create an uphill struggle for themselves.
What we know and what's very clear in the data is that you will have a lower total debt, meaning lower revolving debt like credit cards, lower student loan debt, and you will graduate with a higher credit score compared to those who don't.
Federal student loan payments resumed this month after a pandemic-related three-year pause. The Biden administration's new repayment and forgiveness programs could result in no monthly payments for some. About half of student borrowers continued to make payments during the pandemic, according to Hensley, while 30% were not able to do so. A survey by his group found 83% of borrowers expect to make significant household financial changes, with 23% reporting they'll need to cut their budgets up to $1,000 a month to meet loan payments.
We're estimating that about 1 in 4 U.S. adults may have to cut their discretionary spending, which will be felt locally and nationally throughout the economy.
And Hensley worries some students trying to juggle loan payments will fall victim to scams.
Paying a fee will not improve your odds of any kind of debt cancellation or any kind of repayment options, relief options, nor will it speed that process up. So just be a wary consumer.
Hensley says studentaid.gov can simulate repayment plans to help students identify the best arrangement for their circumstances. This is Roz Brown.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, October 7th, 2023. My name is Jim Santel, and this is Morning Cannolis. This is our 66th broadcast on the stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me both this hour and hopefully next hour for our radio broadcast this Saturday morning. This is, as always, our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those very most important news stories in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. As always this morning, we ask three important questions. We ask what happened. What are the facts? What do we know about what's going on there in our world, our country, our state, our locality? Second, we ask, why are those things important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material to our lives? Why are they significant in understanding what's going around us? And what do we do? What do we do about those kinds of things? What about our actions, our responses, our answers to those most important stories in law, in government, and justice in America? Thank you once again for joining me this morning, Saturday, October 7th of 2023. As always, we have what I'll describe again as an ambitious, but this morning an achievable syllabus in the area principally of civics and understanding what's going on in our courts and outside of our courts, hopefully establishing, providing some frameworks, some going forward in our understanding, our making sense of the times of our lives. Let me talk for a moment or so about that syllabus, our academic plans for this morning, Saturday, October 7th, 2023. First of all, some rule of law snapshots. As always, we're going to talk about two major trials going on just this past week, both of them in New York, although in different neighborhoods, different boroughs of Manhattan, one of them in New York City involving the former president, Donald Trump, a civil lawsuit begun this past week, initiated and prosecuted by the Attorney General of the state of New York. Her name, as you know, is Letitia James, and she is in what is really the second portion of a trial begun this past Monday, continuing into the weeks ahead as we talk about, and they present evidence in that case of the extent to which Donald Trump, his two sons, and his organizations may have engaged in fraud in violation of the laws of the state of New York in connection with the valuation of various properties. We'll talk about what's the status of that case, what has happened, and what the judge, a very colorful judge, has had to deal with this past week in connection with establishing one of the first true gag orders imposed upon the former president in connection with those judicial proceedings. Second, another trial, another courtroom, this one in Brooklyn, but also there in New York State, involving Sam Brinkman-Fried in the New York court as well. And he also in this case, facing allegations of fraud in connection with his management of his cryptocurrency initiative of many years ago. That a criminal case, unlike the Donald Trump case, the case involving SBF, as he is sometimes called, is a criminal matter being prosecuted again by by the federal authorities there in New York. We're going to talk about both of those cases and why they are significant. Second, I'm going to go back to Washington, D.C., briefly to touch upon an issue that we had talked about in our previous broadcast, that having to do with the budget. We all know well now that in the 11th hour on Saturday night, the United States Congress did in fact put together a plan to keep the government open, a 45-day tie-over, if you will, a continuing resolution to keep things in place for 45 days. I'm going to revisit that. And the reason why it is good that government remains in place, remains in operation, but nonetheless a continuing reflection of the ways in which the government continues to fail us in its establishment or non-establishment of a budget on a regular basis. And the impact, once again, that that can and would have upon our judiciary, the trappings of the rule of law in America, certainly federally, and also having some tendrils, some other connections when it comes to our state and local entities as well. Then, as promised last week and in previous broadcasts, I'm going to talk about two important civics issues that have come up from time to time. We have not spent a lot of time in analysis of those. First of all, the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment passed in the wake of the Civil War. I'm going to talk about its language and why it's become relevant once again in connection with the present pursuit of the presidency by at least one of the candidates, his name, once again, Donald Trump, and whether or not the 14th Amendment, by its own words, its own status, is self-executing. Who is responsible for enforcing the 14th Amendment? What does it mean? What does it say? A lot of discussion out there, not just academic, about its impact potentially on the election of 2024. And then, as promised also last week and in previous weeks, we're going to revisit some of the issues related to fake electors. Fake electors, plainly a focus of the major indictments, the criminal indictments in Georgia, which we have talked about at great length. The fake electors in that particular state charged with violations of state law. Another group of fake electors right across Lake Michigan in our sister state, Michigan, also charged by the attorney general there with engaging in criminal conduct in violation of Michigan law that prohibited the kinds of things that allegedly these fake electors did, putting together false documents purporting to be electors in the state of Michigan when in fact they were not, much like what happened here in the state of Wisconsin. As promised, we're going to talk about the bases, the statutory bases, the authority for prosecuting our state electors, our false electors, our fake electors here, the strategy for doing that, the implications that such a prosecution would have in the federal case and also other state cases, and the position taken by our attorney general in a past consideration of this issue about whether or not our fake electors, the 10 or so of them here in the state of Wisconsin, had engaged in any violations of elections laws. That a decision rendered by our attorney general about 18 months ago in March of 2022. Then, as promised in our second hour this morning, we're going to return to the United States Supreme Court. We have chatted about the cases pending before the Supreme Court from time to time. But this morning and in future broadcasts, we're going to revisit some of the things that we've talked about, some of the syllabus, the academic agenda on the docket of the Supreme Court right now. Last week, we introduced three principal cases that were the subject of oral argument just this past week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I dig deep into what the Supreme Court did with those cases, how the Supreme Court justices responded to arguments made by the litigants before them this past week. And then we're going to move on to three other cases coming up in the coming week, also very important in defining not only our nation's jurisprudence, but also defining who we are as a nation, who we should be going forward. All of that coming up in our second hour here on Morning Cannolis. Lots and lots of things to get to, lots and lots of important issues in the area of civics, law, government, and justice in America. So let's begin. Let's begin with our analysis again of these two major cases, one civil, one criminal, pending in New York courts, one state court, one federal court. Let's begin by talking about what happened so far in the civil trial, finding that in the past that Donald Trump and his sons and the corporation for which he's responsible was in fact engaging in violative conduct concerning his inflating assets that he has owned in New York. Specifically, just last week, a judge who's presiding over this civil case pending against Donald Trump, his two sons, and the organization has already found by virtue of entering what's called a summary judgment motion, that Donald Trump and these other defendants were liable for fraud, a civil fraud finding in that case, and that the annual financial statements and other things on which they relied in making representations to banks and insurance companies were filled with examples of misrepresentations about the valuation, the status of various assets, principally in the area of real estate. That the judge, his name is Arthur Engoron. Engoron is his name. He's a Superior Court judge. That's the way the New York courts regard and name the judges there in New York. He has decided already that it's a matter of law and fact that the findings had to be entered pursuant to a summary judgment that he has made, that fraud is in place. And so now in this, the second and presumably third, fourth, fifth, sixth, there's a prediction right now that this case may go well into December, that all of that may be happening in the coming weeks. Going to take a lot of time. Interestingly, the litigants in that case, specifically Donald Trump and his co-defendants, decided to waive a jury. And so this case is being presented directly to Judge Engoron. It's a civil case presented to the court. There is not a jury hearing some specific language here, some specific evidence about what happened. But nonetheless, a judge in the end, the same judge, already found that fraud is a part of this case, that fraud is supported by the evidence. That same judge is going to decide about damages. What kinds of money damages should be entered? What should the judgment here partake of? There are six more counts, believe it or not, that the Attorney General of the state of New York is going to present to the judge, already done this past week and in the weeks ahead, about not only what happened here, but about the value, the actual cost of the things that Donald Trump and his co-defendants did. Six more counts, also tying all of that directly to Donald Trump and the co-defendants in terms of intent. And yes, there's got to be some showing, even inside a civil case, about the intent that the defendant showed in misrepresenting, not only in financial statements, but to others, the actual value of his properties. All of that going ahead right now in that New York state case, the attorney general seeking a $250 million penalty and other punishments against the Trump organization and the Trump players in particular, asking, among other things, not only for a finding of fraud, which the judge has already done, but preventing the Trumps from ever again being responsible for a corporate position of management and authority there in the state of New York. It's a huge deal. It's a big thing to ask for. And once again, the attorney general feeling strongly, and certainly the opening statement suggesting, that she has got the evidence not only to show that the fraud finding is supported, the judge already making that decision, but also, as she goes ahead, that indeed the damages are significant. When we come back after this first break, we're going to talk more about some things that happened in the course of that trial just this past week and a look to the future of those proceedings there in New York City. Stay with us for that discussion here on Morning Cannolis.
To trekking through a kaleidoscope of fall color in Wisconsin. To being like, who's up for whitewater rafting? And turning stories into souvenirs. Here's to rich traditions made new again with good company. And seasonal flavors that taste even better when shared with friends. Here's to those who Wisconsin. Plan your fall getaway at travelwisconsin.com. There's nothing out there close.
Sponsored by Travel Wisconsin.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Up US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous, as in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
1FM WAUK.
Each day through my window, I watch her as she passes by. I say to myself, you're such a lucky.
Welcome back to Morning Cannolis here on Saturday, October 7th. Thank you once again for joining me for our discussion of law, government, and in particular, a couple of important trials going on this past week. A little bit to summarize what those are all about and also tell you about some of the histrionics going on also in that first week of the trial prosecuted by the Attorney General of the State of New York, her name once again, Letitia James, against Donald Trump for inflating the value of his assets, seeking in that case about $250 million in penalties and other declaratory judgment and other things in punishment of Donald Trump and of his co-defendants, including his corporation, for that kind of conduct. Now, fairly, we should say, even though this is a civil case, there's no presumption of innocence. We don't talk about that in civil cases, but it is significant to note that Donald Trump and the other defendants have denied all wrongdoing, and have actually accused the Attorney General, not surprisingly, of being politically motivated. That is what he has done. And in that connection, we know that in the wake of the start of this trial just this past week, Judge Engoron was obliged to order Donald Trump on Tuesday not to attack or even comment on members of the judge's staff on social media. And you may think, well, gee, why did that happen? How did that come about? Well, it came in response to a post by Donald Trump, believe it or not, showing a picture of Judge Engoron's clerk. Her name is Allison Greenfield. She is otherwise unknown, but she is a clerk. She is in the employ of the judicial system there in New York. She is the judge's law clerk. And what does a law clerk do? They are an assistant to the judicial officer, the judge, the justice. They assist with all kinds of legal issues. They are sometimes known, frequently known, to do some ghostwriting whenever there is a judgment that's entered, an oral judgment, a written judgment. Probably been through the hands, through the analysis already of a law clerk who does not importantly stand in the status and the position of the judge, but assists in research, assists in writing, assists in putting together the things that the judge herself or himself wants to do in resolution of the issues, the motions, the cases before them. Someone who is in this assistant role is not in the public domain. Well, what happened here is that Allison Greenfield happened to have a picture at some point, presumably in the distant past, as do probably thousands of people, in the presence of the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer appears in this photograph with Allison Greenfield, Judge Engoron's law clerk, and Donald Trump, without any basis whatsoever, posts on social media a photograph of Ms. Greenfield in Chuck Schumer's presence, and she identifies her as Schumer's girlfriend. Schumer's girlfriend, again, without any basis whatsoever. And that, of course, entirely not just inappropriate, but condemnable. It is. And it is inappropriate for any human being to do that. Certainly someone who right now is in the court there in New York facing the kinds of serious charges that he is. What does that prompt Justice or Judge Engoron to do? He says this. He says, personal attacks on members of my court staff are unacceptable. They're inappropriate, and I will not tolerate them under any circumstances. This is, again, what the judge is saying from the bench in response to what Donald Trump did this past week. The judge, who's known for some fairly lighthearted courtroom atmosphere, speaking very gravely about this. He clarified that his statement prohibited any post, any emails, or any public remarks about members of his staff. He added that, of course, serious sanctions, as do other judges when they're facing similar circumstances, would follow if the particular order, this gag order that he's entering, is not followed, if Donald Trump disobeyed it. But he didn't elaborate. He didn't tell us exactly what is going to happen. And interestingly, of course, probably at the strong encouragement of Donald Trump's own lawyers, that post was taken down after a closed-door meeting in the courtroom, after a morning session early in the week. And again, this admonition from the judge after Donald Trump blasted both the attorney general and the judge himself, a judge or Justice Engoron, for accusing them of being politically motivated. And on Monday, in particular, Donald Trump has said that the judge had engaged in election interference and suggested that he should be criminally investigated. All just wild allegations. Significant again, because it's the first time that we know of in which a judge has specifically addressed Donald Trump and told him cannot do that. We know that Judge Chutkan, who is presiding over the federal district court trial, is going to go to trial in March of this coming year of 2024, has already come very close and has told Donald Trump that he is not to engage in activity that would affect in any way the jury pool or witnesses, but has not specifically imposed a gag order. Now it's happened. Now it's happened here. And as always, we ask the question, well, gee, what could happen down the road? Judge Engoron here now clarifying that if this happens again, he will take further action. That action could in fact involve the jailing, even during the civil trial of the defendant, Donald Trump. Why? Because he would be in contempt of the court order telling him not to do that. And even though, again, this is not a criminal proceeding, that proceeding, a contempt proceeding, could lead to someone who is in violation of the prohibition imposed by the judge, could lead to jail. In fact, that's exactly what happened with respect to Sam Bankman-Fried, the next case we're going to talk about. We will focus again upon that as it happens. Donald Trump, obviously, admonished already by the judge. We also know that this first week involving a lot of financial information, even though the judge already made this decision about summary judgment and a finding of fraud, testimony of a fellow named Donald Bender, who is the former accountant there, describing methodically all this evidence about the former president's annual financial statements, all those indicating that the Trump Organization was responsible for ensuring that those statements were in line with generally accepted accounting principles, which they sometimes would not follow. All of that coming in this past week. When we come back after this next break, we're going to finish up our discussion about that particular case and then move on to the other one involving Sam Bankman-Fried, that happening in federal court in Brooklyn. Stay with us for that next discussion of more cases pending in the courts of America.
Broadcasting to Waukesha and one.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
CBS News Brief. The death toll in Israel is 500, with nearly 2,000 injured after Hamas militants attacked southern Israel from Gaza. Secretary of State Antony Blinken tells CNN Americans could be among the casualties.
We have reports that several Americans were killed. We're working overtime to verify that. At the same time, there are reports of missing Americans, and there again, We're working to verify those reports.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams is dissuading migrants from coming to New York.
We want every single person who's thinking about risking their lives and their children's lives to come to New York City to know the truth about what we are dealing with.
Saying the American dream could become the American nightmare. The head of the United Auto Workers Union says negotiations will continue with the auto companies.
We're going to keep going until we win social and economic justice at the Big Three and beyond.
CBS News Brief. I'm Linda Kenyon.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Howler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
The Todd Alba Show.
You can't impeach someone before they've committed an alleged crime. Even principled conservatives are going to look at that action and say, come on, what's going on?
The Todd Alba Show.
Dan Knoedl, Republican of Germantown, said he was moving forward to uphold his quote-unquote constitutional duty, which is a joke.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. 93.5, The Tap.
Welcome back to Morning Cannolis here on Saturday, October 7th, 2023, finishing up our discussion of the first of these two significant cases pending in New York courts just this past week, just opening this past week, one of them being tried to a judge, to Judge Engoron, this case brought by the Attorney General against Donald Trump, alleging violations of state law and valuations of property. Right before the break, talking about this major testimony of the former accountant during the course of the trial, explaining his accounting principles and explaining on behalf of the prosecution why it was not only that Donald Trump and the corporation itself understood the misrepresentations being made, and specifically identifying the ways in which Trump and the others did not follow the generally accepted accounting principles. That questioning, of course, during the course of this past week, drew consistent objections from Donald Trump's attorneys. They are entitled to do that, who have continued to argue implicitly, if not explicitly, that much of this conduct is beyond the statute of limitations, a decision already rendered by the trial court judge, by the appellate court judge, indicating that those arguments are not in fact based upon any legitimate legal theory. The continuing objections seemed somewhat to frustrate, if you will, the government's lawyer in this case. And as they went back and forth, clarifying objections, arguing about those, at one point, the prosecutor actually let out a heavy sigh during the course of the proceedings this past week. On cross-examination, the Trump attorney tried to shift responsibility for the statements that Mr. Bender was making in his former accounting firm, tried to shift responsibility from the former president to the accounting firm himself, and describing the ways in which, again, attempting to do so, that this is not the responsibility of Donald Trump, but in fact was an accounting problem that this fellow Donald Bender and others had. And the leader of the free world, as the former president was sometimes described in court, not responsible, according to the cross-examination going on this past week. Interestingly, from time to time, the former president also described as the 47th president of the United States of America, which also drew objections from the prosecution. During the course of most of this, Donald Trump has remained fairly quiet, even after being scolded by Justice Engoron early on. But his expressions, even during some of the more lighthearted times of the trial, remain pretty much in a permanent scowl, according to most court watchers. Significantly, Judge Engoron, a fellow who's known again for some of his wisecracks, at some point, as photographers were snapping pictures of Donald Trump at the defense table, the judge indicated, "Oh, the wages of fame." We'll continue to monitor that trial as it goes ahead in the weeks ahead. And now we'll talk more about the Sam Bankman-Fried fraud trial. Again, this one pending in federal court in Brooklyn, brought by the United States Department of Justice. What is he accused of? He was the founder of this collapsed FTX cryptocurrency exchange. And after about a year-long saga that made headlines around the world, when all of this collapsed, devastating the digital asset industry. Now, what specifically is Sam Bankman-Fried accused of? We know according to the complaint, according to the indictment against him, again, those are charges, it's not a finding of guilt. That's what this trial is all about. Charged basically with orchestrating a fairly vast scheme to siphon off billions of dollars of FTX customer money into various things to which it should not have gone, including things like political contributions, real estate purchases, some charitable donations along the way, some venture investments. Also accused of lying to his venture capital backers and to the components that lent FTX money. The scheme apparently focusing on two businesses, FTX and a hedge fund called Alameda Research. And what is the defense to all that? Well, it's going to come out during the course of the trial. Certainly right now, we're in the midst of the criminal presentation by the prosecution, by the U.S. Department of Justice. But we know that after all this happened, FTX filed for bankruptcy. And during the course of those proceedings and in other statements, Bankman-Fried plainly blamed an accounting error of all this, said that that had caused billions of dollars of user funds to vanish, to leave from the books without his knowledge. So once again, maintaining that he's not in fact guilty of the allegations against him, blame this Alameda, this other organization, his colleagues there, for failing to institute proper risk managing protocols. And in some of their pre-trial legal filings, some of his lawyers have said that they also plan to argue that two large law firms also authorized most of these actions that are the subject of the indictment. So what will actually happen during the course of this trial, as it's already begun? We know that three of the closest colleagues of Sam Bankman-Fried are going to testify against him. Alameda's chief executive, her name is Caroline Ellison, and two of the co-founders of FTX, again, along with Bankman-Fried, their names are Nishad Singh and Gary Wang. All of them have already pleaded guilty. They already pleaded guilty in federal court to fraud charges. And significantly, as we've seen in so many other cases, these co-defendants have agreed to do what? To cooperate in providing testimony
against the remaining principal defendant. Again, that's Sam Bankman-Fried. There's a fourth executive. His name is Robert Ryan Salam. He also pleaded guilty without signing a specific cooperation agreement. The judge in that case, again, he's a federal judge. We've talked about him before in other cases. His name is Lewis Kaplan. And during the course of many of the pretrial proceedings here, he has often sided with the prosecution in some procedural disputes, again, not making specific factual findings, but he rejected, for example, a slate of expert witnesses that the defense attorneys had attempted to call. And while this case is going ahead, the other reason why it has a connection to the Donald Trump trial is that Sam Bankman-Fried has already run afoul of the judge's admonition not to talk about this case, not to engage in behavior that could potentially affect those witnesses. And because Sam Bankman-Fried already did that, long before this trial started, the judge, Lewis Kaplan, has already directed that the defendant, Bankman-Fried, spend his time in jail. As he is right now in jail, he's brought out of custody during the course of the trial this past week and in the weeks ahead. But when he leaves at night, he is brought back into custody. Why? Because his bail was revoked by Judge Kaplan based upon the evidence that Judge Kaplan found that Bankman-Fried repeatedly tried to interfere with various witnesses. It is estimated that, like the case involving Donald Trump, across the neighborhoods, across New York, in Manhattan, this one in Brooklyn, slated to last about 6 weeks, according to most court filings. Again, we're going to continue to monitor that case as well as a part of our continuing look at what's happening in the courts in America. We're going to leave New York now for just a few moments and return to another story, much attending to the future of our government, the continuing operation of our government. We know well that two significant things happened just this past week and Capitol Hill, both of them having implications for the rule of law and justice in America, although right now they're heavily steeped in politics and machinations having to do with what happens next. One of them is that at the 11th hour on last Saturday night, about a week or so ago, a deal was struck between the then-president Speaker of the House, his name, Kevin McCarthy, and some members of the Democratic caucus, the Democratic representation there. All the Democratic members, in fact, voting to keep the government operational by putting together this plan to keep not a budget in place. We haven't had a budget, stunningly, in decades, but to put together a continuing resolution by 216-210 vote. It reflected, once again, the very deep polarization happening right now in the House of Representatives. And along the way, part of that deal is the government will continue to operate for about 45 days, which means we've got somewhere around 6 weeks or so to take a look at what is going on, to try to put together a real budget. That probably still won't happen. We kicked this can down the street once again. We visit this all sometime later this fall. We're going to talk again about what our budget should be. But along the way, as a result of that action, as you all well know, just this past week on Tuesday, the House voted to oust Representative Kevin McCarthy from his position as the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the first time in our nation's history that all of that has happened without precedent. And that left the chamber basically without a leader. And we know, in fact, that there's an interim leader, and his name is Patrick McHenry. He's from North Carolina. He is an interim. He was named by McCarthy first on his list of potential interim speakers, and that's what he is right now. Mr. McCarthy, again, this representative from North Carolina, has scheduled another vote on who the next speaker will be for sometime next week, probably next Tuesday or Wednesday. We know already that several individuals, some of those well-known, Jim Jordan, Steve Scalise, others there on Capitol Hill, have indicated they will throw their hats in the ring to become the next Speaker of the House. All of that causing havoc. Again, not only kicking the can down the street, if you will, with respect to the budget, which is again not resolved, but now leadership in the House of Representatives also very much uncertain. And why is that? Why is that significant? Well, it certainly is significant for the operation of our government. As I've said last time and in previous broadcasts, we deserve as citizens, as members of the social status here, all of our culture, our society here in the United States of America, we are entitled as citizens of this nation to have a budget that can be relied upon. It does have an impact when we do not have a budget. It does have an impact upon the fundamental operations of government, including those affecting the courts, including those affecting many, many operational systems, programs that enable people to live their lives, support programs that go well beyond just the political focus in Washington, D.C. We know well the impact that it has upon the basic operations of government, including our military, but many, many programs in all areas of government affected by this as well. All of us as citizens, as members of the American society, have a right to expect more and should expect more. I can tell you, as a former U.S. attorney and former assistant U.S. attorney, confronting these problems routinely in the past, it does have an implication. It slows down the process of government and requires not only that people in positions of responsibility manage the great challenges of not having a budget, but it actually materially impacts the ability to deliver justice in America. The fact now that we no longer have an established Speaker of the House of Representatives, presumably that will take place sometime soon, also stops the movement forward of legislation in many, many areas. We have bemoaned the fact many times that when it comes to major issues like guns and healthcare and education and environment and immigration, the list is long. We necessarily need our government to be able to respond to that in a reasonable and decent way. When we don't have a budget, when our leadership is uncertain, all of those things are not just delayed, but as we often say, are compromised. The longer we go without leadership, without a budget in Washington, D.C., the longer we wait for resolution of those kinds of things. That's not to say, of course, that there will not be political disagreements about all of those kinds of things. But nonetheless, the fact that we do not have those things in place today in what is, by all accounts, by all measurements, a government that should be operational, should be functional for the people of this country, the 340 million of us, it is the kind of thing that should prompt all of us to insist that our government representatives in the House, and yes, also in the Senate, operate in a way that is more consistent with the reasons why we send them there in the first place. We deserve better. We should look forward in the coming weeks to the establishment of a better mechanism and the establishment not only of a budget, but also the placement in that all-important position, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, third in line to the presidency. That has also got to happen as a way of ensuring that our government there in Washington, D.C. and around the country remains strong and vibrant as we go ahead. When we come back, we're going to come back and talk about the 14th Amendment and false electors. Stay with us for that all-important discussion.
Key slides into the ignition. The engine rumbles to life. My hand grips the throttle.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It's the Wild West of how students are using generative AI.
As educators, there's sort of six responses that we can have to these new tools. We could ignore it. Mm-hmm. We could ban it. We can try and outfox it. We can teach about it. We can actually teach it, or we can teach with it. I think the most exciting one, of course, is to teach with it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Segment of our first hour here on Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, October 7th, 2023. Thank you very much for joining me in this hour, closing out our discussion in this first hour of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. A lot of discussion for a number of years now, certainly since January 6th, the events of that day, the insurrection, the riot at our Capitol, about whether or not people who are involved in that riot, in that insurrection, have the ability under the Constitution of the United States of America to serve in public office, having previously taken an oath to the Constitution. Now, we know that the 14th Amendment was passed by the Congress, ratified by the states here in the United States of America in the wake of the Civil War, and basically identifying those people in the country at that time who engaged in the insurrection that we call the Civil War, and prohibiting them, if they have previously taken an oath to support the Constitution, from going forward, serving in a position of responsibility or authority in the federal government or other positions of responsibility in America. That's what the 14th Amendment is all about, described again by many constitutional scholars as self-executing, and among those, and the reason why this issue has come up specifically recently, is that there are a couple of professors. One of them is named William Bowd of the University of Chicago, my alma mater, the law school there. Another one named Michael Stokes Paulson. He's at the University of St. Thomas. They studied this question about whether or not the 14th Amendment should prohibit Donald Trump, and presumably others as well, from being on the ballots in the United States of America for positions of responsibility, positions of authority. Specifically, obviously, Donald Trump now running for the presidency of the United States of America. Professors Bowd and Stokes Paulson, both studying this question for more than a year, and detailed their findings in a major article that prompted a lot of focusing again on whether or not Donald Trump, now running for office, should, under the 14th Amendment, be prohibited from being on the ballot at all, being able to take the presidency, and should therefore not even be on the ballot as a result of the implications of the 14th Amendment for what? For his conduct at the time of the insurrection. Now, we know that that's been charged by the special counsel, Jack Smith, out of the United States Department of Justice. That case, again, pending in the federal district court, charging that singular defendant, Donald Trump, with insurrection for specific counts of violating the civil rights of Americans by attempting to steal their votes those days, and doing other things in violation of the federal criminal law. All of that coming to trial in the spring of this coming year. But along the way, again, these two professors summarizing their conclusion based upon their research, their legal analysis, saying this, is that Donald Trump cannot be president, cannot run for president, cannot become president, cannot hold office
unless 2/3 of the Congress decides to grant him amnesty for his conduct on January 6th. And they're making reference there to a particular provision, kind of a tag on the 14th Amendment, says, oh, by the way, the prohibition of service in the of employ of the people of the United States of America, if you engaged in insurrection, could be taken away. That prohibition could be undone, rescinded by a vote of 2/3 of the Congress. Highly unlikely in this particular case. Their basic affirmation is that Donald Trump cannot be president and therefore should not be on the ballots. Now, that has caused plainly a lot of attention, a lot of focus, a lot of people deciding whether or not that conclusion is right or not. Among the people who have taken a look at that, you've also got a fellow named Federal Judge Michael Luttig, who has also appeared before the Congress, and Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, who made the same case in an article published in The Atlantic. And those two wrote, the disqualification clause operates independently of any criminal proceedings and also independently of impeachment proceedings and of congressional legislation. Those two went on to say, this clause, the 14th Amendment, was designed to operate directly and immediately upon those who betray their oaths to the Constitution, whether by taking up arms to overturn our government or by waging war on our government by attempting to overturn a presidential election through a bloodless coup. Obviously, those professors, those folks are talking about Donald Trump and specifically joining in the decision, the writings of Professors Bowd and of Stokes Paulson, saying that the 14th Amendment prohibits Donald Trump from being in the presidency of the United States of America. Along the way, we've also had some political people weigh in on this. We know that Asa Hutchinson, who is the former governor of the state of Arkansas, a present candidate for the Republican nomination, said this. He said, over a year ago, I said that Donald Trump was morally disqualified from being president again as a result of what happened on January 6th. More people are understanding the importance of that. And that's the reason why we're talking about it this morning, including conservative legal scholars. That, again, Governor Asa Hutchinson, he said that during the course of the campaign. That, of course, specifically rearticulated by him during the course of the first debate in the attempt, his attempt and the attempt of others to secure the nomination of the Republican Party. Asa Hutchinson at that time saying, I'm not going to support somebody who's been convicted of a serious felony or is disqualified under our Constitution. Now, Donald Trump, once again, not yet convicted of any crime. Even that civil case we talked about before in the first segments of this hour, that's a civil matter, regardless of what the judge does there, not a criminal conviction. Plainly the case pending in front of Judge Chutkan in Washington, D.C. is that criminal proceeding. That will happen, presumably, in the spring of 2024. Asa Hutchinson and others saying that whether it's a conviction or generally disqualified under our Constitution should not be able to take that office. Indeed, the question is, how do you go about executing the 14th Amendment? Lots of disagreement out there. You've got some people in New Hampshire and South Florida and Michigan who are filing lawsuits right now, attempting to get declaratory judgments in those jurisdictions that the former president in those states should not appear on the ballots. Those going ahead again, New Hampshire, South Florida, Michigan, other places around the nation, we have got lawsuits that are being filed to establish or not establish that. We'll see what happens with the 14th Amendment down the road. A reason to understand the reason why it is so significant and will have an impact plainly, not only this year, but in the coming year as that campaign goes forward. Stay with us for the second hour this morning of Morning Cannolis when we talk about another aspect of January 6th having to do with fake electors. Stay with us for that discussion here on Morning Cannolis.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weichert Realtors Lake Point in Madison, homeowner.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanction lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25. 5 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls. W228EP Eau Claire. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.